From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is Woodward. I want to talk about Watergate. I know
we're
not
going to talk about that subject.
Well, we talked about Wallace.
But this is different.
That was about the shooting of a man running for president.
This is different.
How?
Not about this story. Don't call me again.
Who was Deep Throat?
There was a list that I happened to see on TV. It was the 10 greatest mysteries of the 20th century. And number five was Deep Throat. Number one was the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. You know, there's a difference there. With Amelia Earhart, nobody knows what happened. But with Deep Throat, people know, but they're not telling us.
A University of Illinois professor and his class say they've uncovered the identity of Deep Throat. We'll find out who they believe exposed the story behind the break-in of Watergate, one of the largest political scandals in the nation's history. The FBI has admitted it secretly confiscated a package that was being sent from one AP reporter to another. The FBI opened an investigation, but journalism experts claim it has greatly overstepped its bounds and has infringed on the free speech of the press. We'll go to Iraq to look at one of the many untold stories of the recent invasion, a U.S. bombing in late March that hit a family farmhouse, killing three. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has turned himself in to U.S. forces. Aziz gave himself up in Baghdad after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary, this according to the London Guardian. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's current whereabouts. He was the only Christian in the former Iraqi government and not a member of Saddam's hand-picked Tikrit clan. He never wielded power and was just number 43 on the list of 55 most wanted Iraqis. But the fact that he is alive suggests that Saddam Hussein and his son may also still be alive. The Guardian reports Aziz may possess explosive information on the extent of the West Pass support for Saddam Hussein. He was appointed foreign minister in 1983 and was largely credited with securing Western support for Iraq against Iran. Aziz became prominent in 1991 following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait when he led talks in various countries trying to avert war. Several months ago, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill interviewed Tariq Aziz.
All the pretexts which are being used against Iraq and the leadership of Iraq are false pretexts. The issue, as it was said, is oil. The issue is to impose American imperialistic control on Iraq.
Tariq Aziz, we have more on his surrender in the other hour of the expanded Democracy Now! Key oil-exporting countries agreed today to cut crude oil exports by 2 million barrels per day starting in June to try to stem a fall in prices and make way for the expected resumption of Iraqi exports this summer. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries made the decision at its meeting in Vienna today. Iraq did not attend the meeting for the first time since OPEC was founded in Baghdad in 1960. Its former oil minister is on the list of Iraqi officials most wanted by the United States. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. government is setting up Iraq's oil industry to run like an American corporation, with a chief executive and management team vetted by U.S. officials who would answer to a multinational board of advisors. The advisory board will be chaired by Philip Carroll, the former chief executive of Shell Oil. Carroll will represent Iraq at future OPEC meetings. Fadil Othman is expected to be named the Iraqi vice chair. He worked as an Iraqi oil executive before Saddam Hussein came to power. The interim management team will be composed of current and former Iraqi oil sector officials. Newly appointed executives will answer to the advisory board, which in turn will answer to General Jay Garner, the new U.S. ruler of Iraq. U.S. Marines have begun patrolling stretches of the Iraqi border with Iran to screen border traffic for so-called hostile infiltrators. The operation began amid concern in Washington that Iranians may be entering the country to stir up anti-American sentiment among fellow Iraqi Shia. U.S. Central Command said the Marine Border Patrols will search, review, interview, and possibly detain all people attempting to enter and leave Iraq through Iran. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting the U.S. may use Iran's main rebel group, the Iraq-based People's Mujahideen, to pressure Tehran as tensions rise between the two countries over post-Saddam Iraq. For years, Washington shunned the heavily armed group as a terrorist organization. The left-leaning group broke with the ruling clergy after the 1979 revolution against the U.S.-backed Shah and waged a bloody campaign in the early 1980s with a wave of assassinations of top officials. According to the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, some members of Congress now see the Mujahideen as the best thing since sliced bread. The British Defense Ministry said yesterday soldiers returning from the Gulf will be offered tests to check levels of depleted uranium in their bodies. The tests will assess whether they're in danger of suffering kidney damage and lung cancer as a result of exposure to the U.S. and British munitions. The ministry was responding to a warning earlier in the day from Britain's premier scientific body, the Royal Society, that soldiers and civilians might be exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The warning challenged earlier reassurances from the British Defense Secretary that depleted uranium is not a risk. This news from Pennsylvania, a 14-year-old boy armed with three handguns shot and killed his junior high school principal before fatally shooting himself in the head. James Robert Sheets was an eighth-grade student at Red Lion Area Junior High School, located in a quiet community north of Baltimore. School and police officials described Sheets as a nice, average kid who had no known history of trouble with the principal or anyone else. The first face-to-face talks between North Korea and the U.S. on North Korea's nuclear program have ended badly a day earlier than planned. U.S. officials said Pyongyang admitted it had nuclear weapons. When President Bush heard this, he accused North Korea of using blackmail. North Korea says it put forward a bold proposal, but said the U.S. merely repeated its demand that North Korea scrap its nuclear program before further dialogue. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said, quote, strong views were expressed, which the BBC says is a diplomatic euphemism for a major argument. Chinese officials sealed off a second major hospital today, and the government was forced to deny martial law is imminent as roadblocks were thrown up around Beijing to combat SARS. The Ditan Hospital is treating more than 100 SARS patients. 600 medical staff were told they can't go home. This after China yesterday quarantined thousands of Beijing residents who've had contact with suspected carriers of the deadly virus. Isolation orders were imposed on homes, factories, and schools, and residents are being monitored to ensure that they don't flee. An official circular from the Beijing municipal government, meanwhile, said all college students and teachers are, quote, prohibited from leaving the capital for the May Day holidays. At Beijing's railway stations, throngs of people are trying to escape despite inflated ticket prices. China announced another five deaths and nearly 200 new cases. China's SARS death toll is now at 115. Meanwhile, two people have died from SARS in the Philippines. All of this comes as health advocates are trying to draw attention to malaria today on Africa Malaria Day. Malaria is far more deadly than SARS. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund published report that some 3,000 African children die every day of the disease. 1 million people die every year. But malaria generally strikes only impoverished people in the global south, whereas SARS appears to cross both class and country lines, with Toronto, Canada, under a WHO travel advisory. The WHO is calling for the most malaria-effective drugs to be made more widely available. Even insecticide-treated mosquito nets could reduce malaria transmission up to 60%. Attorney General John Ashcroft has ruled that broad categories of foreigners who arrive in the U.S. illegally can be detained indefinitely without consideration of their individual circumstances if immigration officials say their release would endanger national security. Ashcroft released the far-reaching decision yesterday in denying bond to an 18-year-old Haitian who landed in Florida with more than 200 other refugees. The Washington Post reports the ruling means that groups of asylum seekers can be locked up without hearings and without resource to release on bond. Immigration advocates denounce the ruling. The executive director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, Cheryl Little, said, quote, "You'd think the attorney general would have better things to do these days than target an innocent Haitian asylum seeker." She also said detentions of an earlier boatload of Haitians had cost the government $12.5 million over a six-month period. Today is the deadline for male immigrants from Egypt, Kuwait, Jordan, Indonesia, and Bangladesh to register with the U.S. government. Immigrants who report to authorities are photographed, fingerprinted, questioned, and in some cases detained and deported. During the last 5 months, nearly 130,000 male immigrants and visitors, predominantly Muslim, have been questioned in immigration offices, airports, and border crossings. A UN vote on gay rights was derailed yesterday at the last minute by an alliance of Muslim countries. The UN had been due to vote on the matter for the first time in its almost 60-year history, but five Muslim countries delayed the vote until today and introduced amendments that remove all references to discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and render the resolution meaningless. UN sources told The Guardian that major U.S. allies, Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, as well as Libya and Malaysia, were doing everything they could to stop the resolution. And finally, Winnie Mandela, South Africa's former First Lady and heroine of the struggle against apartheid, faces a maximum sentence of 15 years in prison after being found guilty yesterday on 43 charges of fraud and 25 of theft. She is expected to be sentenced today. She pleaded not guilty.
As I raise my hand to broadcast my objection to latest triumph draws the final straw. Who died and lifted you up to perfection? What silenced me is written into law. I can't believe where circumstances thrown me, and I turn my head away. If I look, I'm not sure that I could face you. Not again. Not today. Not today.
The Final Straw, R.E.M., here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last September, a reporter with the Associated Press in the Philippines sent a FedEx package to a colleague in Washington. The package contained unclassified FBI documents. Reporters send such items often, but this one never made it to Washington. FedEx officials originally said the package may have fallen off its delivery van, but AP officials were suspicious of what happened. And now it turns out the package was never lost. It was seized and confiscated by the FBI. In an April 3rd letter released this week, the FBI acknowledged that its agents had confiscated the package at Customs. Unnamed FBI officials told the New York Times the documents seized were too sensitive for public consumption. The package contained a report with detailed materials seized from the apartment of a man convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. The FBI also announced this week it had opened an internal investigation to determine whether its agents abused their authority by secretly seizing the documents. We go now to Lucy Dalglish. She is executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about this case and what this means for journalism?
Well, you know, journalists, as you mentioned a moment ago, journalists use this type of information all the time, and they are sending it back and forth to each other. And I think an important thing to add to your description of this case is that these records, not only were they unclassified, but they had been entered into evidence in two trials, including the 1993 World Trade Center bombing trial. And they were introduced in open court. They were public records. And anyone who wanted to go to the court and spend the money and wait for them to make duplicates would have been entitled to get these records. It just so happened that someone at the AP in the Philippines had the records and said, no, you know, don't go to the court. I'll just overnight them to you. It'll be faster. It'll be easier. It'll be cheaper. This is the type of thing that journalists always worry about, particularly in times like these, when it seems as though the government is trying to, you know, if perhaps with good motives, the government is trying to really restrict the flow of information to the public.
How did the FBI know that the reporter in the Philippines was sending this?
Oh, it was a very typical thing. When you send a Federal Express package from overseas, it goes to a centralized processing facility. In this case, it was Indianapolis. And every time anybody sends a package, Customs has the right to open anything, and they do a random check. Now, I believe Customs probably was just doing a routine check. Now, we know that it had to have gotten to the country because at the same time, an identical package was being sent from the Philippines to New York. The New York package made it. The Washington, D.C. package did not. So Customs opens it, sees that these are FBI documents, calls the FBI and says, hey, you know, maybe you want to look at this. And the FBI came and looked at it, and instead of getting a warrant and going through the motions of doing, you know, if they had a concern, there is a legal process for how they can detain this package. Instead, they just took it.
Now, the AP reporter, John Solomon, mm-hmm. was the same reporter whose home phone records were subpoenaed by the Justice Department in 2001 to try to determine the source of leaks and articles he had written about an investigation into Senator Robert Torricelli of New Jersey. Is that right?
That's true.
John Solomon has been under a lot of scrutiny, it looks like.
I don't think any FBI agent in Indianapolis would have had a clue who John Solomon is. And I've talked to John about this, and he doesn't think that the package was seized because his name was on it. He thinks it was seized because of what was inside it. Now, John Solomon is one heck of an aggressive reporter. And if they're keeping an eye on him, that wouldn't surprise me much. But he believes this particular incident with the FedEx package was fairly random. I don't know if that's what he thinks about the Torricelli thing.
In looking at the New York Times piece about this, it quotes an FBI official defending the Bureau's handling of the confiscating of the FedEx packet. It says, this was an internal FBI document. It was not something that was supposed to be released publicly. It's taking something from an FBI file and handing it to someone. This document was not the property of the Associated Press. That's the rub, he said.
No, that's just completely false. As I said, these documents had been introduced into a public trial. They then become public documents, public records. And anybody, your mother could go off tomorrow and ask for those documents and get them. They are unclassified. Now, they contained a lot of information about the materials used in some bombings, but they were not sealed in court. And the jury and anyone who was watching that trial would have seen these documents.
So what about FedEx and all of this? At first they thought FedEx said that it dropped off their truck. But this means they, too, are cooperating with the FBI. And are they handing over documents when they don't have subpoenas?
Well, I'm not quite sure exactly how this works. So I'm not, likely to, I'm not going to point the finger at FedEx at this point. But, there, like I said, there's a process where every FedEx package coming in from overseas goes through customs. I think FedEx probably had a duty to keep track of its packages, and when the AP, followed up and said, "Hey, we're missing something," I think they had a duty to, track it down, figure out exactly what happened. But I don't know what the process is within customs as to how much knowledge they would have had about what actually happened to that package.
So, what is the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press calling for?
I'm sorry.
What is your committee calling for? The Reporters Committee for
Freedom
of the Press.
Well, I think I applaud Senator Grassley for writing that letter and asking for the FBI investigation. That's clearly something that has to be done. And we agree with him and would, we're waiting to see what the FBI report comes up with. My hope is that the folks probably in the Indianapolis field office where I think this happened, unless they called Washington and got somebody higher up to say it, I'm hoping that they face some sort of disciplinary action.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Lucy Dalglish, Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. When we come back from break, who is Deep Throat? A college professor thinks he knows. Stay with us. Music by The Dirty Three here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. It may be one of the greatest mysteries of the 20th century. Who was Deep Throat? Who was the White House insider who tipped off the Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein? Based on information from Deep Throat, they began to piece together the deep secrets of the White House. Their stories led to the demise of the Nixon presidency. For nearly three decades, the person's identity has been unknown to but a handful at the Washington Post. But now, after a four-year investigation, an University of Illinois journalism professor and his class believe they have solved the mystery. Maybe you saw All the President's Men, Robert Redford playing Bob Woodward. This was one of the scenes.
I want to talk about Watergate. I know that
we're not going to talk about that subject.
Well, we talked about Wallace.
But this is different.
That was about the shooting of a man running for president.
This is different.
How?
Not about this story. Don't call me again.
The professor, who thinks he does know, is William Gaines. He joins us now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
So, who was Deep Throat?
Fred Fielding. Fred Fielding was Deep Throat. We're certain of it. We would not have gone ahead and announced that. We see examining the records, the documents that we assembled over 4 years, that nobody else could be Deep Throat other than Mr. Fielding. He has all the qualifications, and he had access to the information that Deep Throat had. In many instances, we found that he would be the only person, the only living person, who had such access to particular bits of information that Deep Throat had. So we're certain that it's Fred Fielding. Fred Fielding was the chief deputy to John Dean at the time of Watergate, and he's an active attorney. He's very accomplished. He's very trusted. He's a recognized authority.
Professor Gaines, as you know, because you teach young people, for a lot of people, they won't even know who John Dean was. So if you can explain each step of the way and each figure in this investigation.
Well, John Dean was involved in the cover-up itself as a chief counsel to President Nixon, the cover-up of the White House involvement in the break-in of the Watergate office complex, the Democratic National Committee headquarters. So he was a part of the cover-up. He then, months later, went public and testified against Nixon. So there were many heroes of the Watergate era. John Dean was one of them. Deep Throat, Fred Fielding was another.
How did you find this out?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Can you talk about how you found this out, the process of elimination, and have you spoken to Fred Fielding himself?
I'll answer the first question, how it worked. We approached this with the idea that everybody in the world was a possible suspect as being Deep Throat, and we eliminated individuals based on information in All the President's Men. The book that Woodward and Bernstein wrote, it's a work of nonfiction, autobiographical in nature, and written by a couple of very good reporters. So we established the fact from the start that what they wrote about was true. We worked out a formula in which we eliminated individuals one by one. Over the years, Woodward and Bernstein have given us many clues as to who Deep Throat is. The fact that he's still living, that he smokes, that he drinks scotch, and things like that. And so as we went down the list of individuals, we narrowed the location of Deep Throat in the White House based on access to information. And then we went through the roster of White House employees at the time, staff members, high-level officials, and we eliminated individuals till we got down to seven. Last June, which was the 30th anniversary of Watergate, we had seven suspects. And what we did then was concentrate on them. It could be no one else. We eliminated individuals if we could find they were somewhere else at the time when Woodward and Bernstein were meeting, or rather Woodward was meeting with Deep Throat in the garage. And finally, we did concentrate on a few individuals, and then from records that we assembled over 4 years, we pulled together. It was one of those things, like I think in an investigation, suddenly it just all comes together. And the students and I discussed it, we worked on it, and we saw that Fred Fielding was the only individual who fit the description of Deep Throat and had access to that information. We have contacted him. We tried several times to reach him by phone, by email. About 2 weeks ago, we sent him a letter, an overnight letter, and got a receipt back that he had received it. And in that letter, we stated exactly the information that we had, so he would know what we were going to be saying in our report, so he'd have a chance to respond. he hasn't responded to us, and I don't believe that he's responded to any of the news media, as far as I know.
We're talking to Professor William Gaines, University of Illinois professor, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Chicago Tribune. What role did your students play? This was a four-year investigation.
Yes, it was 4 years. Of course, the students changed every semester. There were eight semesters of students, and so it was pretty difficult. We started out from scratch, not knowing too much. Each time we would be on a roll, you know, the students understanding what to pursue, why they'd be gone and they'd be a new class. I'd have to get them up to speed. And then the amount of information accumulated to the degree that it would be half the semester would be gone before I could explain what we had. But it all came together in the last two semesters. The students had studied 16,000 pages of FBI reports that we got. We studied the testimony from the Watergate hearings. We looked at transcripts of civil suits. We read the books that participants in Watergate had written. It just seemed like everybody wrote a book, and that was pretty good for us, you know, because it was just, even though many of those persons like Haldeman and Ehrlichman, the top assistants to Nixon, had died, it was just like we were able to get an interview with them, because they told us in their first-person account books what happened as far as they were concerned. So with all that information, the students were kept busy. Another thing we did was we created a database. We used an Excel spreadsheet, and it was a simple database. We kept a chronology of events in that, and the students would take a floppy disk around with them. They'd go to the library and do research, and most of the information we had, of course, was it was public record or it was published information, and a lot of it came from the library. And they would gather information, they'd put it on the floppy disk, and we would combine it with the main program. And it was a searchable, sortable database. Didn't tell us who Deep Throat was, but it was a good way to keep our statistics and our facts organized.
Professor William Gaines is our guest from the University of Illinois. Urbana-Champaign says he solved the Deep Throat riddle, that it is Fred Fielding, who was the attorney for John Dean. Now, can you take us through the Watergate break-in and how he would know what he knew, when it was, and why it was so significant?
Well, one of the aspects of the Watergate break-in, you know, Howard Hunt was a supervisor of the burglars, and Howard Hunt was a consultant to the White House. He was on the White House payroll. He had an office in the White House, and he had a safe in the White House. The first day, the Monday morning after the Saturday break-in, Fred Fielding was asked by John Dean to open Howard Hunt's safe and inventory what was in there. And when he did that, he found that there were embarrassing files that Hunt had. Hunt was using his White House office for espionage against the political opponents of the Nixon administration. And so Fred Fielding was the first person to see those documents. And then also he was in the White House. He was present at the time, or was told by John Dean about specific conversations that took place that day and during the next week that Deep Throat knew about. Very few people knew about this situation. Also, Fred Fielding was able to read FBI reports that were shipped over from the FBI to John Dean. It was an unusual circumstance. The FBI is investigating people in the White House, and meanwhile, John Dean was getting all their reports. John Dean had gone to the acting director of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, and asked for the reports. And Gray told him that he can't give them out. They're confidential FBI reports. But Dean said, well, I'm the chief counsel for President Nixon, and the president wants them. And so Gray said, well, okay, if that's the case, I guess you could have them. And they were shipped over. They were picked up by Fielding, and in some instances he testified that he read them. Information from those FBI reports was very closely held, and it was the exclusive information that, that Deep Throat had. So we traced many instances of facts that were passed along by Deep Throat to Woodward, to Fred Fielding.
So you tried to get Fred Fielding's response. You know he received your investigation and your conclusion that Deep Throat is Fred Fielding. He hasn't responded. What about Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporters? Have you talked to them?
We attempted early on to talk to Bob Woodward, and he declined to talk to us. He said that he wouldn't discuss a subject that a good reporter protects his sources. With Carl Bernstein, it was a little different. One of the students called him, and he became very irate when he was told about our project. And he said that he didn't respect our project, that he thought it was wrong for us to be revealing another reporter's source. It was not a good thing to be teaching journalists to do. Well, I myself don't see it quite that way. I agree that a reporter does not reveal his or her source. Definitely, you just don't do it. What they have done, though, is actually reveal the source by making a movie character out of him. I tell my students, if you have a source, you don't say anything. What they have done is make a movie character. They have given us hints as to who their source was and how they met and what the source said and actually described him physically. So it's become more of a game. And I, at the turn of the century, I saw a list of the top mysteries of the 20th century, and Deep Throat was number five. The disappearance of Amelia Earhart was number one. And there's a difference with the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Nobody knows what happened to her. But with Deep Throat, somebody knows, and they're not telling us. So that was a challenge to us, and that's how we replied to Bernstein's complaint. But both Woodward and Bernstein have not commented on our findings. However, the fact that Bernstein was pretty much upset by the fact that we're doing it gave us more confidence that we are correct.
We're talking tonight, Professor Bill Gaines, an investigative reporter with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Let's talk about Fred Fielding today. Going back a little in time, you have a piece, Who is Deep Throat? It starts, I'm in charge here. Then Secretary of State Alexander Haig told the press as President Reagan was undergoing surgery in 1981 to remove the bullet of a would-be assassin. But Haig had misstated the laws of presidential succession. Someone would have to set him straight. No, Al, Fred Fielding told Haig as he left the press conference. Fielding is among the most respected legal minds in government. Deputy assistant to President Nixon, chief counsel to Reagan for 5 years, a member of the Bush-Cheney transition team, and today a member of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks, all the while quietly issuing legal opinions away from the center stage. Fred Fielding today continues to be a player in Washington.
Yes, he's very important. He's on the 10-member 9/11 commission, and the other members are former senators and former governors. So you can see the stature that he has to receive an appointment of that type.
What project are you working on next, Professor Gaines? What source has to cover his or her trail very carefully now?
Well, I don't know that we will work on the same type of a story again. This was never a planned project of a great research by the university. It was just a classroom exercise. It grew and grew because people were interested in it. And so we didn't plan it. The next time when we do something, we will plan what we're going to do in advance, and we've gotten a lot of suggestions, and I'm certainly open for more. I would like to do something that has a little more social significance. You can say, okay, what's it all mean? And the reason that we continued to pursue it until the very end was that people asked us to do that. There was so much great interest in it that nobody else could take on the job. Newspapers were not going to investigate another newspaper, and there wouldn't be no government investigation of this type of a story. So it was left to some independent entity like an investigative reporting class at the university to do something like this. So we're open for ideas, and we don't have anything specific, but we would probably want to do something that has a lot of social significance and is going to resolve some issue that has been a question for a long while.
Professor William Gaines, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the Chicago Tribune, Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Iraq to break a story about a family that had taken refuge in a home and was bombed during the U.S. invasion. Stay with us.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A month ago, an Iraqi farmhouse was hit by a U.S. missile. Three members of the family that was taking refuge inside were killed. They were among the unknown number of civilians who've died during the U.S. invasion. The website IraqBodyCount.net estimates that as many as 2,380 Iraqi civilians have been killed. The numbers could be far higher. Well, today we're going to start off with a report by freelance journalist Julia Guest, who went to the farmhouse that was bombed.
Dalia, a beautiful fruit-growing region outside Baghdad, was considered a safe area by the Al-Jaburis and many other Iraqi families seeking a place to survive the war. 17-year-old Ahmed had been standing in the field.
The plane passed overhead and fired a rocket.
On March 24th at 4 p.m., three young people were killed as a rocket hit their uncle's farmhouse. The first floor of their home was demolished in the attack. Three families of the Al-Jaburi family had shared this farmhouse. They had prepared everything for the coming months. Food rations were stored, they had a cow and chickens and local farm produce. This would have meant an easier life than staying in the centre of Baghdad. I met their neighbours who explained what they had seen and had happened to their houses.
What we saw was the plane firing three rockets. One rocket hit the house, and two fell at a distance.
البيوت المجاورة ها
The houses nearby, all of them were destroyed, even TV sets as a result of the force of the blast. We even have children whose eardrums popped from the force of the blast.
I met the family in the Yarmouk hospital in Baghdad just hours after the attack. 9-year-old Rana suffered concussion and chest, lung and arm injuries. Only found out his young wife Nada was buried under the rubble when he reached the hospital. Asma's 8-year-old daughter Zara died in her arms. 4-year-old Mohammed's face was covered in shrapnel wounds.
They hit this child. What could this child do against the Americans? He only likes to play. Now they have deprived him. Why? Give me one reason, one convincing reason for all this.
You talk of peace, of the doves of peace, but they're gone.
A 14-year-old Nada sustained leg and skull injuries. Omar and Nada were married just a week, and she was buried with her sister-in-law and cousin the day after the bombing. The family and neighbors insisted no military targets were nearby, and no one could understand why this had happened.
And that report by freelance reporter Julia Guest, who joins us on the line right now. She's recently come out of Iraq and is now in London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Julia.
Hi, Amy.
Can you talk about how you discovered this family and the story of the U.S. missile that hit their home?
Sure. We were actually taken to one of the hospitals on a sort of fairly routine hospital visit, and the family were just brought into the casualty unit as we were there, and we saw the state of their injuries and the extent of the damage done to them. I asked to be taken to the farmhouse, which they had to seek permission for, as it was quite a way outside Baghdad, but we got that the next day and were taken straight there.
Who is we? And then how did you track down this story?
Okay. I was with the Iraq peace team, who were taking some witness reports for potentially bringing court cases against the U.S. and the British government for war crimes against civilians. And we were taken there by some of the Iraqi guides who were working with us. The case against for this family is pretty clear cut. There was very clearly no reason for them to be bombed, and it seems that it was almost a vindictive bombing. I mean, there was no air defense battery in that region. There's certainly no way that it could have been anti-aircraft. There were rockets that were fired straight through the roof. And I'm now very concerned that not only should their case be brought, but also that some compensation should be taken back to Iraq and to at least give them some small chance. I mean, they've now lost their home, relatives. Some of them were severely injured. I think it's the absolute minimum that could happen at this stage.
Now, Julia, you originally pitched this story to the BBC, who you have worked for before. What happened?
Yeah. I transmitted the video to them, and they decided on the basis of the quality of the resolution was too low, which I found a bit odd. And then I brought the tapes back to London, and they presented it to a program, an 8 o'clock roundup of reports from Iraq, and they decided it was too early to show this kind of program, and they quite literally turned around and said, well, we think it's just too strong, that And it made me question about how much it's possible to personalize stories.
They said they think it's too strong?
Yeah.
Meaning?
Well, it was a very personal account. It named names. It showed people's injuries. It made connections with the family. And I know a lot of the reporting has been quite depersonalized. I think generally there's a tendency for a lot of the footage that has come out of Iraq has been very, very totally detached from individual people. When corporations are spending £1 million to put a camera on a tank, and yet don't want to run just ordinary civilian diaries or stories, then you just question what's happening in the media across the board.
It's interesting, Julia. This report just came out in The Independent. The director general of the BBC attacked U.S. television and radio networks for their, quote, shocking and gung-ho coverage of the invasion of Iraq. Greg Dyke warned against new British government proposals that would allow U.S. media corporations to take a greater share of British television and radio. He said they could lead to a loss of impartiality in news coverage. In his first public comments since the war, Dyke said, quote, the U.S. has no news operation strong enough or brave enough to stand up to the White House and Pentagon.
Uh-huh. Well, I didn't obviously see a lot of the American coverage. What little I did see, I mean, things like the image on the back of a tank, utterly pointless. They don't convey information. It's just a static image. I think, to their credit, the BBC were one of the few corporations that remained inside Baghdad when every other major channel left. That they weren't prepared to go a step further and start including more personalised reports, I think, was a great shame. I'm sure that, you know, if they're, you know, in the long term, they may be able to do it at more of a distance, but it's, I think there is quite clearly lines are drawn about where, how far they can personalise a story during a war.
What are your plans now? And by the way, once again, you said that this farmhouse had no military installations nearby?
None whatsoever. And all the local people were quite adamant about that. They were absolutely insisting that there was nothing around whatsoever. I certainly couldn't see anything. It was a very peaceful fruit-growing district. There would have been no reason to defend it. There would be no obvious target there. And I know that in the past, certainly, that bombing in the no-fly zone has seen this happen before. Hundreds and hundreds of families went to these farmhouses around the suburbs of Baghdad to be safe from the bombing. So they clearly also believed there was no danger. My plans now are to go back to Iraq, and any money I can raise for this family, I will take to them if I can find them somewhere. I have as many dresses as I could gather from them before we left them. I'm also planning to go and work with a group of students who want to start their own indie media site, and I think this is incredibly important that some people in Iraq now have the opportunity at least to start expressing what they feel. Certainly the whole time I was there, if the consistent comment was that nobody wanted to have a war, not for any reason. Varying sort of opinions on their own internal politics, but that was fairly consistently something for them to resolve. So I think it's incredibly important now that people, the Iraqi people, get a chance to get a say and to be listened to. So I'm going to head back out there and offer what support I can to this project. And also I hope to make a film with them about their work on in realizing this, and I hope that that could be something that a Western audience could appreciate, and that it would be something for the long-term recovery in Iraq, because I think very clearly the breakdown in communication has sort of with individual people sort of understanding each other and as a whole country, it's absolutely vital.
Well, Julia Guest, I want to thank you very much for bringing us this story. Julia Guest, an independent reporter, she was in Iraq, now in Britain, heads back to Iraq soon. And we hope to follow up with you when you return to Iraq to visit the survivors of this family. It so much reminds me of Masuda Sultan, a story we've continued to cover, a young Afghan American woman who went back to her family in Kandahar. They had left Kandahar and traveled miles outside to a farmhouse to be safe from the U.S. bombing. It was there that their farmhouse was bombed by U.S. planes, and she lost, I believe, 18 members of her family. Julia Guest, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In the last few minutes of the program that we have left, we go to Ali Abu Nima, who runs the electronic intifada.net website. And Ali has found and posted just this morning secret documents from the Luntz Research Companies that outline Israel's public relations to sway public opinion in this country. Can you lay out, Ali, what you have posted?
Yes, it's at electronicintifada.net. This is a document prepared for pro-Israel activists and the Israeli government by the Luntz Research Companies and the Israel Project, which is a pro-Israel coalition in this country. It's incredible stuff. What it does is it counsels pro-Israel advocates on how to build support for Israel's hardline policies. It tells them to keep invoking the name of Saddam Hussein and to stress that Israel was always behind American efforts to rid the world of this ruthless dictator. Despite his solid support for Israel and Ariel Sharon, it warns Israel not to compliment or praise President Bush because that could alienate democratic supporters of Israel. And at the same time, it acknowledges that Yasser Arafat has been a great asset to Israel because he looks the part of the terrorist. Let me read you one bit, which I think is particularly telling. It says, and I quote, "To some extent, your job as proponents of Israel has been easy. Under the Arafat regime, it's not difficult to convince the American public of the corruption of the current Palestinian leadership. While many sympathize with the plight of the Palestinian people, there is no love lost for Yasser Arafat. Arafat is a terrorist, they know that. Better still, he looks the part. The emergence of Mahmoud Abbas as the new Palestinian prime minister comes at exactly the wrong time. His ascent to power seems legitimate. He's a fresh face and a clean-shaven one at that. He speaks well and dresses in Western garb. He may even genuinely want peace. Just as President Bush had begun to make headway in drawing attention on the need for a reformed Palestinian leadership, the Palestinians throw us this curveball." So this document is suffused with cynicism, with an attempt to manipulate U.S. public opinion, an attempt to exploit the war with Iraq in order to preserve the status quo in Israel. It's really incredible stuff, and the reason we've published it is because we think there's a major public interest in knowing the way the pro-Israel lobby is trying to manipulate the United States into maintaining support for Sharon's government.
Ali Abu Nima, thank you for being with us, founder of electronicintifada.net, and this this document from the Luntz Company is on electronicintifada.net. Thank you very much for being with us. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burkhenge, Karen Sharif, Abdul Qudus, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, with help from Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. A very special thanks to Angela Alston. If you want a copy of today's show, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! I don't have-
have illusions about the policies of the United States, and the United States is not looking after the welfare of the Iraqi people. The United States government is conducting a belligerent policy for its own greedy interests.
U.S. forces have detained former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. We will speak with Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, who interviewed him several times, and analyst Dilip Hero. Beijing has sealed another hospital and ordered 4,000 people to stay at home. We'll look at the SARS crisis. And in Tulia, Texas, Tom Coleman has been indicted on 3 counts of perjury. He's the sheriff's deputy whose sole testimony led to the controversial drug sting that led to the arrest of 10% of the African-American population of Tulia.
He was the lieutenant county of the operation. There are much bigger fish to fry in Tulia.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has turned himself in to U.S. forces. Aziz gave himself up in Baghdad after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary, this according to the Guardian of London. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's current whereabouts. But the fact is that he is alive suggests that Saddam Hussein and his sons may also still be alive. The Guardian reports Aziz may possess explosive information on the extent of the West's past support for Saddam. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. Key oil exporting countries agreed today to cut crude oil exports by 2 million barrels per day starting in June to try to stem the fall of prices and make way for the expected resumption of Iraqi exports later this summer. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, made the decision at its Vienna meeting. Iraq did not attend the meeting for the first time since OPEC was founded in Baghdad in 1960. Its former oil minister is on the list of most wanted Iraqi officials. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. government is setting up Iraq's oil industry to run like an American corporation, with a chief executive and management team vetted by U.S. officials who would answer to a multinational board of advisors. The advisory board will be chaired by Philip Carroll. He's the former chief executive of Shell Oil. Carroll will represent Iraq at future OPEC meetings. Fadhil Othman is expected to be named the Iraqi vice chair. He worked as an Iraqi oil executive before Saddam Hussein came to power. The interim management team will be composed of current and former Iraqi oil sector officials. Newly appointed executives will answer to the advisory board, which in turn will answer to General Jay Garner, the new U.S. ruler of Iraq. U.S. Marines have begun patrolling stretches of the Iraqi border with Iran to screen border traffic for so-called hostile infiltrators. The operation began amid concern in Washington that Iranians may be entering Iraq to stir up anti-American sentiment among fellow Iraqi Shiite. U.S. Central Command said the Marine Border Patrols will search, interview, and possibly detain all people attempting to enter and leave Iraq through Iran. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting the U.S. may use Iran's main rebel group, the Iraq-based People's Mujahideen, to pressure Tehran as tensions rise between the two countries over post-Saddam Iraq. For years, Washington shunned the heavily armed group as a terrorist organization. The left-leaning group broke with the ruling clergy after the 1979 revolution against the U.S.-backed Shah and waged a bloody campaign in the early 1980s with a wave of assassinations of top officials. The British Defense Ministry said yesterday soldiers returning from the Gulf will be offered tests to check levels of depleted uranium in their bodies. The tests will assess whether they're in danger of suffering kidney damage and lung cancer as a result of exposure to U.S. and British munitions. The ministry was responding to a warning earlier in the day from Britain's premier scientific body, the Royal Society, that soldiers and civilians might be exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The warning challenged earlier reassurances from the British Defense Secretary that depleted uranium is not a risk. This news from Pennsylvania, 14-year-old boy armed with 3 handguns shot and killed his junior high school principal before fatally shooting himself in the head. James Robert Sheets was an 8th grade student at Red Lion Area Junior High School, located in a quiet community north of Baltimore. School and police officials described Sheets as a nice average kid who had no known history of trouble with the principal or anyone else. And this news about North Korea, it has admitted to the United States for the first time that it possesses nuclear weapons and threatened during talks in Beijing to test or export them. This according to a senior U.S. official in the Financial Times. The bellicose warning and North Korea's demand for bilateral meetings without the Chinese hosts led to the talks' collapse. The U.S. had long suspected North Korea had 1 or 2 nuclear bombs, and this was confirmed by Pyongyang's envoy at a dinner Wednesday night after the first of 3 scheduled talks on North Korea's nuclear program. Chinese officials sealed off a second major hospital today, and roadblocks were thrown up around Beijing to combat SARS. This after China yesterday quarantined thousands of Beijing residents who've had contact with suspected carriers of the deadly virus. All college students and teachers are prohibited from leaving the capital for the May Day holidays, but throngs of people are trying to escape at Beijing's railway stations. China announced another 5 deaths and nearly 200 new cases. All of this comes as health advocates are trying to draw attention to malaria today on Africa Malaria Day. Malaria is far more deadly than SARS. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund are reporting that some 3,000 African children die every day of the disease. 1 million people die every year. But malaria generally strikes impoverished people in the global south, whereas SARS appears to cross both class and country lines. More on these stories later in the program. Attorney General John Ashcroft has ruled that broad categories of foreigners who arrive in the U.S. illegally can be detained indefinitely without consideration of their individual circumstances if immigration officials say their release would endanger national security. Ashcroft released the far-reaching decision yesterday in denying bond to an 18-year-old Haitian who landed in Florida with more than 200 other refugees. The Washington Post reports the ruling means that groups of asylum seekers can be locked up without hearings and without recourse to release on bond. Immigration advocates denounce the ruling. The executive director of the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, Cheryl Little, said, quote, "You'd think the attorney general would have better things to do these days than target an innocent Haitian asylum seeker." She also said detentions of an earlier boatload of Haitians had cost the government $12.5 million over a 6-month period. Today is the deadline for male immigrants from Egypt, Kuwait, Jordan, Indonesia, and Bangladesh to register with the U.S. government. Immigrants who report to authorities are photographed, fingerprinted, questioned, and in some cases detained and deported. During the last 5 months, nearly 130,000 male immigrants and visitors, predominantly Muslims, have been questioned in immigration offices, airports, and border crossings. A UN vote on gay rights was derailed yesterday at the last minute by an alliance of Muslim countries. The UN had been due to vote on the matter for the first time in its almost 60-year history. But 5 Muslim countries delayed the vote until today and introduced amendments that remove all references to discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and render the resolution meaningless. UN sources told The Guardian that major U.S. allies Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, as well as Libya and Malaysia, are doing everything they can to stop the resolution. And a South African court has sentenced anti-apartheid heroine Winnie Mandela to 5 years in jail after being convicted on dozens of counts of fraud and theft. Mandela immediately resigned from parliament and posts in the ruling African National Congress. State prosecutors said letters bearing her signature were used to secure loans for bogus employees of the ANC Women's League, which she heads. Her lawyers argued she was duped into participating in a fraud she knew nothing about. Winnie Mandela is known as the mother of the nation for her struggle against apartheid during her former husband Nelson Mandela's 27-year imprisonment. After the sentencing, she released a statement saying, quote, "The ANC is my home, its ideals are my passion, and its endeavors to make South Africa a just society is a cause that I will not relinquish." Finally, the Director General of the BBC has attacked U.S. television and radio networks for their, quote, "shocking and gung-ho" coverage of the invasion of Iraq. Greg Dyke warned against new British government proposals that would allow U.S. media corporations to take a greater share of British television and radio. He said they could lead to a loss of impartiality in news coverage. In his first public comments since the invasion, Dyke said, quote, "The U.S. has no news operation strong enough or brave enough to stand up to the White House and Pentagon." Dyke should have said no corporate news outlet is strong enough to take a stand.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Michael, my dear, don't say this about us.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Michael Franti, listener sponsored. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has turned himself in to U.S. forces. Aziz gave himself up in Baghdad after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary, according to the London Guardian. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or Saddam's current whereabouts. But the fact that he's alive suggests Saddam Hussein and his sons may still be alive. He was the only Christian in the former Iraqi government and not a member of Saddam's hand-picked Tikrit clan. He never wielded power and was number 43 on the list of 55 most wanted Iraqis. The Guardian reports Aziz may possess explosive information on the extent of the West's past support for Saddam Hussein. He was appointed foreign minister in 1983, was largely credited with securing Western support for Iraq against Iran. Aziz became prominent in 1991 following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait when he led talks in various countries trying to avert war. We will be going to Dilip Hero in a minute, but first to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, who interviewed Tariq Aziz several times over the last year in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you give us more on his history and his significance right now?
Well, I'm wondering who is going to be leading Tariq Aziz's interrogation. Will it be his old friend Donald Rumsfeld, who he shook hands with in 1984 at a time when the U.S. was aware that Iraq was actively using chemical weapons, or his old friend Jim Baker, the former Secretary of State? who he praised. The first time that I met Tariq Aziz, my impression was that this man has the politics of a classic member of the Republican Party. He went on and on for at least 20 minutes about how fond he was of the Iraqi relationship with the Reagan administration during the 80s, and how those were times that he remembered as solid between Iraq and the United States. Tariq Aziz was the only Christian, as you said, who was in Saddam Hussein's ruling elite. I would not say that he was in the inner circle. Particularly over the last 2 years, what we saw was a real consolidation of the power of the Tikridis. We saw the rise of Naji Sabri as the Iraqi foreign minister. Tariq Aziz was primarily relegated to the role as the public face for the Western world. He wasn't the public face of the regime for the Arab world. That was much more the role of Naji Sabri, the foreign minister. Tariq Aziz was someone who would meet with foreign dignitaries when they would come to Baghdad. He would meet with solidarity groups. He was a Ba'athist ideologue, and that was the primary role that he served for Saddam Hussein's regime, was to build solidarity ties with groups around the world. Yes, I think it is true that one of the reasons why he was able to survive was because he had no true popular support base in Iraq. He was very seldom used for domestic propaganda purposes. He was known as Iraq's most famous diplomat. And, I mean, this was a man, this was one of the preeminent diplomats of the Arab world over the last two decades. He was a man who worked behind the scenes diligently at trying to secure a very close relationship with the United States throughout the 1980s. He was the public face of the regime in 1990 and 91 during the so-called Gulf War. He was the public face of the regime again in 1998 when the Clinton administration bombed Iraq for 4 days. You know, this is extraordinarily significant for propaganda purposes on the part of the United States, because he's perhaps the second most recognizable Iraqi in the world, second only to Saddam Hussein. But as far as what Tariq Aziz really knows, the only thing I think that's of concrete value to the United States is that he knows how the process works. He knows how the system works. He knows how the Ba'ath regime functioned. But I don't think this is a man who knows where Saddam Hussein is. I don't think this is a man who knows where any potential weapons of mass destruction are. This was a man who was not anywhere near the ultimate inner circle in Iraq.
Jeremy, can you set up this interview that you did with Tariq Aziz in mid-May when you talked to him about what he thought of U.S. foreign policy towards Iraq? Where did you do the interview?
This was at a time when the United States was really beginning to escalate its threats against Iraq. I was in Baghdad, and any time you are going to be interviewing any high Iraqi officials, there's always a degree of uncertainty to how that's going to go down. And so I only knew that it was going to be on a particular day that I would be meeting Tariq Aziz. And sure enough, it was very late at night. People from the Iraqi foreign ministry and the secret police came to the hotel. They said, you need to put on a suit and tie and be downstairs in 5 minutes. So I ran upstairs. I quickly shaved, put on a tie, which I had to borrow, actually, from someone at the hotel. And then they put me and a colleague in a Mercedes, in the back seat of a Mercedes-Benz with totally tinted windows, couldn't see out, no one could see in. And we drove around the city for a good 20 minutes before we ended up in an underground garage. And then next thing I know, I'm in an elevator with people in Ba'ath Party uniforms, and we're taken in, and Tariq Aziz comes walking out wearing house slippers and his Ba'ath Party uniform and smoking a Cuban cigar. And then he takes us into the room, sits us down in his leather chairs, and says, so what do you want to talk about?
Well, let's take a listen to what he had to say. This is Tariq Aziz last May, interviewed by Jeremy Scahill.
This policy of the U.S. government is not a new one. It started in 1990. It continued throughout the whole decade under the first Bush administration, under the Clinton administration, and now under the George W. Bush administration. The main objective of the American belligerent policy is to impose its influence over the whole region. All the pretexts which are being used against Iraq and the leadership of Iraq are false pretexts. The issue, as it was said, is oil. the issue is to impose American imperialistic control on Iraq in order to use the resources of Iraq for the benefit, for the greedy interest of American capitalism. This is the issue. Iraq is not producing weapons of mass destruction. They are lying, you see, and using those allegations as a pretext to disinform the American public opinion about the reality of the situation and get a false support to their military threats. Well, for us as a people, when we are being threatened, we have to prepare ourselves for such a development.
There have been reports this week that the United States is increasing its attempts to organize the so-called Iraqi opposition, increasing the funding, trying to bring them together. How is Iraq going to respond to these actions by Washington with the Iraq opposition groups?
Frankly speaking, we do not care about all these activities because they are a complete failure. There isn't an opposition to our leadership that can have integrity and respectability. That's not the issue. The issue or the real concern is when the bombs are thrown at our people. America can throw bombs and missiles at any place in Iraq, and that creates death and destruction. But we are not worried about the opposition, you see. Let them do what they want. They are spending their own money, the taxpayer money, you see, on those people who are worthless and who cannot do anything serious.
It's been well documented that the United States and other foreign entities have attempted to kill the president of this country. There have been assassination attempts. Are those activities continuing today?
They say that we want to target President Saddam Hussein, we want to target the Iraqi leadership. They are doing that, but as we say, we leave it to God, you see. God is the great protector of our leadership, of our leader, of our people. And here, among our people in Iraq, we feel very safe.
Would this country be prepared to endure yet another massive bombing? Would the government be able to survive that if the Bush administration began a massive bombing of this country?
Well, we hope that there will be no massive bombing of our country. But if that takes place, we will survive. Yes, we did survive in 1991. We are a courageous people. We are in our country. We are fighting in our country. We are not fighting outside our country. So when you fight in your own home, with the help of God, with the help of all honest people in the world, yes, you will survive. And we are optimistic that we will survive.
How did the September 11th attacks, do you think, impact the current situation between Washington and Iraq?
Well, Iraq has nothing to do with those events. We saw them on television, as many people in the whole world, in the United States, saw them. We do not condone the killing of people, you see. We do not rejoice that. We have been the victims of many terroristic attacks against us by the pro-Iranian groups in the past. But the American government is using those tragic events in pushing forward towards a very belligerent militaristic policy, global-wise, you see, which is a real threat to the whole world, as it is a threat to Iraq, because they are targeting Iraq as one of their next victims in the so-called war against terror.
That was Tariq Aziz speaking to Jeremy Scahill last May. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Dilip Hero will talk about the fact that Tariq Aziz is now in U.S. custody, having turned himself in yesterday. Stay with us.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name. not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
Not in our name, Saul Williams here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we return to Jeremy Scahill's interview with Tariq Aziz last May. Again, he has turned himself in to U.S. forces in Baghdad. The reports are that he turned himself in after discussions with U.S. forces through an intermediary. Intelligence experts say Aziz is unlikely to possess information about weapons of mass destruction or weapons or Saddam's current whereabouts. This is Tariq Aziz.
Some people, especially in the U.S. and the U.K. governments, are focusing on one issue of the whole picture. The whole picture is the suffering of the Iraqi people, the sanctions which have been imposed for more than 12 years. What about lifting the sanctions? The inspectors stayed in Iraq for around 8 years. They did not report honestly to the Security Council that their mission had been done and accomplished. If they are back and back to the previous vicious circle, that's not going to solve any problem for the people of Iraq. Secondly, there is one important fact in the whole picture. The American government, with the help of the British government, attacked Iraq a number of times in 1993, 1996, and in 1998, while the inspectors were in Iraq, you see? So the question of inspection is not going to solve the military threats. It might be used, you see, as a pretext, as the inspectors themselves might be used, you see, to prepare the ground for a military attack. So
that is an excerpt of an interview with Tariq Aziz done last May. Again, he has turned himself in to U.S. forces after having discussions with an intermediary. This, according to the London Guardian. We go now to Dilip Hero, journalist, author of 24 books, including his latest, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dilip Hero.
Good morning to you.
His significance, Tariq Aziz, what you think he knows now, what do you think of him surrendering?
Yes, I think he has surrendered because he has to remember that Mr. Aziz is 66 years old. Okay, so I think it's not very easy for a man of that age to move around, run around. Of course, one might as well say that Saddam Hussein is 65 years old, but Saddam Hussein has got a very strong body of bodyguards and other supporters that they can move him around and make sure that he's not too uncomfortable. But somebody like Mr. Tariq Aziz, who was never very close into the close circle, did not have that many bodyguards to move him around. So apparently he thought better to surrender, and also to say that, of course, to remember that Tariq Aziz is his not real name. His real name is Mikhail Yahuna. He is a Chaldean Catholic Christian. And, you know, in that sense, he's not a part of the what you may call the top Sunni Muslim leadership of the Ba'ath Party, which was running the country until, of course, recently.
Dilip Hero, what about his relationship with the United States over the years, his friendship or relationship with James Baker in the leading up to the first Gulf War?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's nothing like he had anything, you know, independent of Saddam Hussein, because nothing moved. Grass did not grow in Iraq unless Saddam Hussein said it should grow or it could grow. See, so therefore he wasn't in any way setting up some kind of a back channel to the Americans without the knowledge of Saddam Hussein. You know, he was very loyal to Saddam Hussein. If you look at his brief biography, which is in my Dictionary of the Middle East, he joined the Ba'ath Party when he was 18 years old. You know, and that means in 1954. He was born in 1936, and he was the editor of the Ba'ath Party newspaper, Al-Thawra, which means the revolution. And, of course, you know, and at that time, Saddam Hussein was a young man. And, of course, as Saddam Hussein's star rose, he attached his loyalty to Saddam Hussein and rose with him. But whatever happened had to be sanctioned and, in fact, guided by Saddam Hussein, you know, and it had to do with hello? You know, basically what happened during Iran-Iraq War 1980 to 88. See, it is during that period that Saddam Hussein developed very strong relations with America, starting with getting intelligence reports from the National Security Agency and the CIA, and those meetings that used to take place in Amman, under the auspices of King Jordan King Hussein of Jordan, and I don't think he himself would travel to Amman to talk to the CIA, etc., etc. But you see, the main thing about Tariq Aziz is that he has postgraduate degree from Baghdad University in English, and because he was fluent in English, I mean, he is fluent in English, and that was gave him the importance of a foreign minister and a deputy prime minister. He traveled a great deal. He was the intelligent, articulate face of Saddam Hussein's regime to the Western world. That did not mean he had much input in the real policy making, which was the privilege of Saddam Hussein and his very close advisors, and of course his two sons, Uday and Qusay.
The latest news we have is that a son of the former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz negotiated his father's surrender over a satellite phone with the help of a friend in the United States. Who is his son, De La Pira?
No, I'm afraid, I mean, I don't have any such details about it. You see, I mean, I can talk about general policies, etc. You know, who exactly did what. I mean, that is something I'm sure is left to people who are in that business. I think I know Tariq Aziz's background, and also to remember, and this is something worth remembering, that his importance, at least as the deputy prime minister, and of course Saddam was the prime minister as well as president, was that he was a Christian, and that established the secular credentials of the Ba'ath Party. Also to remember that the three leaders who set up the Ba'ath Party in 1947, one of them, in fact, the ideologue, was a man called Michel Aflaq. Now, Michel Aflaq was Christian, Greek Orthodox. I think that is something to bear in mind, that, you know, those people who try constantly, even now they haven't given up, to keep pinning Al-Qaeda to Iraq and Saddam Hussein, tend to forget that Al-Qaeda is a purely religious, Islamic fundamentalist organization which under no circumstances would deal with a regime where the deputy prime minister like Tariq Aziz, whose real name, I have to say again, is Mikhail Yahuna, and, you know, cooperate with him. Because according to people like bin Laden, all Christians are crusaders. So the whole idea that has been, you know, propped up in America, and which was one of the reasons to go in and attack a country like Iraq, was that Iraq had links with Al-Qaeda. And so I'm just giving you this understanding that the very basics of the regime were secular, and Tariq Aziz was the face of that particular secular Ba'athist socialism and nationalism. And so I think in that sense he was very important to the regime. But that doesn't mean, I have to repeat, that he had real input into the policy making, because that was the privilege of very few people who were close to Saddam Hussein, who related to him. And of course, at the same time, he was very loyal. He was always very loyal to Saddam Hussein, and that's why he rose to the position that he did.
Finally, the extent to which Tariq Aziz will talk about the U.S. relationship with Iraq over the years and its support of Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime. Do you think the U.S. is concerned about this and will strike a deal with Tariq Aziz?
Sorry, with the U.S. Sorry?
Is concerned about this and will strike a deal with Tariq Aziz.
Strike a deal. I think Tariq Aziz, I'm sorry, Tariq Aziz, strike and use Tariq Aziz is not going to get American policy anywhere. Because see, Tariq Aziz does not have his own constituency. Please remember that Christians are only 4% of the population of Iraq. 96% of the people in Iraq are Muslim, of which 60%, as we know, are Shiite. And of the remaining 36%, half of them are actually Kurds. 95% of Kurds are Sunni, but of course they do not put this up front because the Kurdish minority and the Arab majority divide themselves vertically as ethnically different. So they don't get into whether they are Sunni or Shia. And then among Arabs, you have the Sunni and Shia divide. And in that particular equation, I don't think, you know, Tariq Aziz figures anywhere. I don't think he's going to be able to make one iota of difference, even if he fully cooperates with America. So what? You know, I mean, he doesn't have any constituency of his own. In the past, his job was to basically a PR man, public relations man, you know, because of his fluency in English. He was very well-traveled, and all the major diplomatic things that happened, he traveled widely because, of course, he's an Arab, he speaks Arabic, and his role was very important at the time of the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq war. I also remember one simple thing, which is very important to bear in mind. The Islamic Revolution happened in Iran in February 1979. On the 1st of April of that year, they declared Islamic Republic of Iran, and on the first anniversary of that establishment of Islamic Republic of Iran, there was an assassination attempt on Tariq Aziz in Baghdad, and this was done by, you know, a very militant Shia group called Al-Dawa, and that was a starting point of bad blood between Saddam Hussein and the Iranian regime under Ayatollah Khomeini. So I think what I'm trying to point out that, you know, the fact he was Christian was the reason why the militant Shia Al-Dawa activists tried to kill him. And see, and that was the very important event between Iran and Iraq. And from then, of course, relations became very bad. You know, from April 1980, and that was the 1st of April, very important because this was the anniversary of the establishment of Islamic Republic. And it within 6 months, Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, you know. So I think that is something to bear in mind. But his use to Americans is zilch, because I don't think he actually knows, you know, exactly what went on. And even if this is a big, big, big if, there are some weapons of mass destruction somewhere, I don't think he has a clue where they are, what I don't know, what, and so on and so forth. And therefore, I don't think it will be of any particular use to the Americans.
Well, DeLapiro, I want to thank you very much for joining us, journalist and author of 2 dozen books, including Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, speaking to us from London. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to SARS. Chinese officials sealed off a second major hospital and threw up roadblocks up around Beijing today to deal with SARS. The government announced another 5 deaths and nearly 200 new cases of the deadly virus. China's SARS death toll is now at 115. China yesterday quarantined thousands of Beijing residents who've had contact with suspected carriers of the virus. Isolation orders were imposed on homes, factories, and schools. Residents are being monitored to ensure that they don't flee. Throngs of people are trying to escape at Beijing's railway stations. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization said yesterday Vietnam, one of the first countries to be hit by SARS, had controlled the killer virus, showing that other countries can also contain the virus. Dan Sermon is with us from Vietnam. He's in Hanoi. He's head of Doctors Without Borders SARS mission in Hanoi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, good evening.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the situation in Vietnam?
The situation right now in Vietnam, I can tell you that in the hospital of Bac Mai, the public hospital of Hanoi, where Doctors Without Borders is working now since a month and a half, there is only 4 patients remaining today. So we can say that the epidemic, the SARS epidemic outbreaks, is more or less stabilized now and controlled in Hanoi and in Vietnam.
Can you talk about how Vietnam is containing the virus and the difference between Vietnam and China? You're headed to Hong Kong on Monday.
The fact is, for the case of the Vietnam, it was possible to have a better control on the epidemic, as far as one hospital was the reference hospital for all SARS cases. So all patients and all SARS cases was referring in this hospital. So it was really easy, in fact, when isolation procedure and protection protocols were given to the medical staff to isolate and to protect the medical staff who is working in this hospital. And I think is maybe the major difference with what's happened by now in Hong Kong or in China. For the Vietnam case, it's that we are only one hospital where all the staff patients were transferred. So it was easy to control and to manage this epidemic.
We're talking to Dan Sermon, head of Doctors Without Borders in Hanoi. We're going to go to break, and we'll also be joined by Rachel Cohen to talk about SARS, but also how it compares to, for example, malaria on this Africa Malaria Day. Stay with us.
Well, now we're hoping that this war won't spread beyond the current state that it is.
Baghdad Radio says Saddam Hussein braved Allied bombs to visit his troops in Kuwait. The Allies are hitting elite Iraqi troops with all their power.
Why is it that George Bush, who says he loves peace, has led the nation into war?
Why are we in this war?
1991's begun, and money's 21 now. I don't know, somehow picking up a gun now, loaded with gunpowder, fighting for the system's wrong. The blacks down now, before we used to diss them.
Of this nation, we make up 12%. The front line seems to misrepresent, cause I hear that they're working more than 30% of color there, fighting for some oil, but you think we'll ever get a share?
So don't gas me to go and get gas in the worst way. I'm the first to say pass, G, and don't think that you're taking me by sending me a draft card. Oh, you're making me laugh hard.
So rant rave, cause I know you say we got to, but I ain't your slave.
Plus my papa told me not.
Time for peace, Paris, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take on the issue of SARS, the outbreak comes as health advocates are also trying to draw attention to malaria today. It's Africa Malaria Day. Malaria is far more deadly than SARS. The World Health Organization and UNICEF are reporting that some 3,000 African children die every day of malaria, 1 million people die every year. But malaria generally strikes impoverished people in the global south, whereas SARS appears to cross both class and country lines, with Toronto, Canada, under a World Health Organization travel advisory. The WHO is calling for the most effective malaria drugs to be made more widely available. Even insecticide-treated mosquito nets could reduce malaria transmission by up to 60%. In addition to Dan Sermon on the line with us from Hanoi with Doctors Without Borders, we're joined by Rachel Cohen, who is also with Doctors Without Borders. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about the comparison between malaria and SARS and the attention?
Certainly. I think first it's important to say that there is no reason to have to compare or rank or prioritize what is causing human death and suffering. But for us, as a medical humanitarian organization faced constantly with the incredible devastation caused by diseases like malaria and tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS, what's frustrating is to see what can happen when a global public health threat is acknowledged, particularly when that public health threat is viewed as affecting people in wealthy countries like the U.S. and Canada. Massive financial, political, and scientific resources can clearly be marshaled to mount effective responses to a public health threat like SARS, while, as you said, we're witnessing one child dying of malaria every 30 seconds in Africa, 350 deaths every hour from AIDS alone. So for us, it's quite frustrating, even though we're very happy to see massive mobilization of resources for for this public health threat, which is SARS, it's quite frustrating not to see similar or proportional efforts to confront massive pandemics such as HIV, malaria, and TB.
If you were in charge of the World Health Organization, how would you deal with SARS and malaria, for example, now? How would you do it differently?
Well, I think simply we need to look at what the actual toll is. Obviously, it's important that there have been 4,000 or so reported cases of SARS and roughly 250 deaths from that disease. But, and I think it's appropriate that there are massive resources being devoted to mapping the genome, for example, and looking for treatments rapidly. But for diseases that are either predominantly or exclusively affecting poor people, we see no such parallel effort. There's virtually no research and development, for example, happening for diseases like African sleeping sickness or Kala-Azar, which are claiming hundreds of thousands of lives every year. But because they only affect poor people, there's no market incentive, there's no market interest in developing treatments for those diseases, and because they don't affect people in wealthy countries, it's not considered by the public sector, by governments, to be a priority either. So what we simply need to do is have a needs-based, needs-driven assessment of what all of the needs are, both in terms of prevention, treatment, but also R&D, research and development, to develop new treatments for these diseases, and have resources mobilized and allocated according to those needs.
What about the role of the U.S. government, specifically USAID?
USAID has played a very interesting role in terms of malaria. It's actually much like what we saw with the AIDS epidemic several years ago. A couple of years ago, as people may recall, Andrew Natsios, the administrator of USAID, said that Africans were had a different sense of time than those of us in wealthy countries, and that they would not be able to comply with complicated antiretroviral therapy for the treatment of HIV. Of course, this sparked outrage throughout Africa and among those in the AIDS community, but they're saying a similar thing about malaria. At the moment, there are levels of resistance to common antimalarial treatments in Africa, such as chloroquine or Fansidar, which are reaching now 90 to 100% in some regions. It's already reached those levels in Southeast Asia and quickly approaching. These drugs are quickly becoming useless to us in the field and in places in Africa. There are, however, alternatives which are far more effective. They're called artemisinin-based combination therapies, but they're also more expensive. And what USAID is arguing is that it's simply too costly and too complicated at this time to implement more effective treatment. What they say is even if a treatment is less efficacious, if people take it more frequently, the overall effectiveness profile makes it more worthwhile. But we don't feel that's not a responsible public health response when you have a more effective treatment.
Let me go back to Dan Sermon, head of Doctors Without Borders' SARS mission in Hanoi. How does this compare to other diseases in Vietnam? For example, the level of contagion. Dan Sermon, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry. I didn't hear the whole question. I think we were...
How does this compare... SARS in Vietnam, the level of contagion versus other diseases?
The fact is SARS take now became a huge phenomenon here in East Asia. So it's difficult again to compare, and we cannot compare with other kind of diseases present in the country as well. All the eyes are focused now on the SARS business, and everybody and public opinion and laboratories and scientists and everybody is focused on this SARS business by now. So it's difficult for us to try to have an idea on the rest of all the kind of disease that we can find in Vietnam. Doctor Without Borders just arrived here a month and a half ago, invited by WHO, just to work in this hospital for isolation and protection of the medical staff, which was our first priority. because we realized that 50% of the medical staff were the first people who were infected by the virus, because they are in close contact with the patients. And it was our job here to come and to set up a new isolation wards and to train the medical staff on nursing barriers and also on the protection protocols to be sure that none of them will be infected. So it shows that even the donors, even the public opinion, and all the eyes is focused on this SARS phenomenon. What would be interesting now that the situation is more stabilized for Vietnam is to see what will happen after. This will be really important to see how Vietnam will react now on the rest of the other issues who are really important in public health in this country.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Dan Sermon, head of Doctors Without Borders, SARS mission, speaking to us from Hanoi, Vietnam. And Rachel Cohen, also with Doctors Without Borders, the Access to Medicines campaign here in New York. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we move now into our final segment, the undercover officer who ran a drug sting in Tulsa, Texas, 4 years ago, was indicted yesterday on charges of lying under oath during recent hearings to determine if the convictions he obtained were legitimate. In 1998 and 1999, Tom Coleman single-handedly ran an undercover sting operation that ended with the arrests of 10% of the black population of Tulsa, Texas. Coleman never presented any audio or video evidence connecting the residents to a crime. But local courts convicted 38 of the residents. Most of them were poor and African American. 13 remain in jail. Yesterday, a Swisher County grand jury in Texas handed down a 3-count indictment that accuses Coleman of making false statements about legal problems he faced in another county while working for the Panhandle Drug Task Force. If convicted, Coleman, who's no longer in law enforcement, faces up to 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine on each of the 3 counts. We're joined by Jeff Blackburn, who is a civil rights lawyer, head of the Tulsa Legal Defense Project, on the line from Texas, and Randy Credico with the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice here in our studio. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Jeff. Talk about the significance of this indictment, a case we've been following now for a number of years.
Symbolically, it's extraordinary. It's really incredible to see in that courthouse this happen. This is a courthouse that has become synonymous around the country with injustice and with a really evil working of the criminal justice system. So now what we've begun to see is some table turning and some change happen there. So symbolically, it's very powerful. Practically, we have a long, long way to go on many different levels. We still have people in prison that have to get out. We've got a lot of work to do with the Court of Criminal Appeals. This is going to help us, certainly morally, but legally we have a huge and very difficult fight still ahead of us.
Randy Credico, you've been working on this case for some, 4 or 5 years now?
About 3 years.
Three years. Remind us of what happened and who Tom Coleman was.
Well, Tom Coleman was an itinerant law enforcement undercover agent who was working as a welder, who got a job with the Panhandle Regional Narcotics Task Force assigned to Swisher County, Tulsa in particular. And some days he'd arrest prostitutes in Amarillo. But he, in a year and a half period of time, made about 140 cases against 46 people in Tulsa. And he had no surveillance. He had no corroboration of any kind. Most of the information that he gathered, he wrote down on his leg. And using that kind of evidence, he was able to get about, I think, 8 convictions in trials in Tulsa. He lied in every case. In fact, Sarah Kunstler and I were at one of the trials at the end, and I mean, the guy was lying. We could not believe that they'd come back with a conviction. And they did, the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar White trial. And he put away, in the end, about 20 people in prison, 25, and the other people got probation. Their lives are completely ruined. They're out of work. If they're not in prison, they're out of work. They have no place to go. They can't vote, no public housing, and this is still happening. But he's not the only person at fault here. it's a system in Texas. He's kind of the Lieutenant Callie of the operation, where the Medinas and the Nixons are the ones from the Panhandle Regional Narcotics Task Force who really are responsible for this mess. They did it. They knew he was lying. They knew he was making up cases. But the more cases you make up, the more money you receive from the state and from the federal matching fund programs.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Blackburn, did the state know about Tom Coleman's history? Why did they choose him to begin with?
Without question, they not only knew about his history, but they knew about him lying under oath. From the first trial forward, it became clear to them that this was a guy who was making it up as he went, testifying, as we like to call it down here. Now, the problem that we have is that the real wrongdoers, just as Randy pointed out, that we've identified from the very beginning. I mean, Coleman essentially was just a good employee. It's not for nothing he got plaques and awards for doing what he did, but what he essentially was all about was doing as he was told. And the real wrongdoers in this case, this task force, the whole system of narcotics law enforcement in Texas, has yet to really be brought to justice for what happened here. It's going to be very easy for them now to look at this indictment and say, well, we fixed the system in Texas. We're a long, long way from doing that, and we're a long way, even in the context of this case, from really exposing the truth about what happened and pointing out the true wrongdoers that told Coleman what to do, that directed him in what to do, and that covered for him in the courthouse.
Do you think this indictment would ever have gone down? And, of course, it's an indictment. It's not a conviction. If it hadn't been for the outside attention, particularly the national media, Randy Cretico?
Absolutely not. This has been a great example of mobilization through the media. This show here, Democracy Now!, really kicked it off back in 2000. Back in October, it got other big shows involved, got 2020 involved, New York Times got involved afterwards, and definitely it's even Bill O'Reilly is talking about it. So this outside pressure that really started right here and on your sister station here at WBAI is responsible, and I really, you know.
Which goes to the question of, how many other Tulias are there?
They're all over the state.
That aren't getting this kind of
attention. There's a place in Caldwell, Texas, in Burleson County, a similar situation that went on. And, I mean, actually, it's all over the state. We get more letters from Texas, the Kunstler Fund, than we do out of New York, people complaining about similar situations.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much. We'll continue to follow this story. Randy Cretico of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice and Jeff Blackburn, head of the Tulia Legal Defense Project. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That does it for the show. If you want to get a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website for more information and web links is www.democracynow.org. And our email address is mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Angela Alston and Emily Kunstler. Also, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, and Johnny Sender. Karen Renucci, Fatima Mojadidi, Rich Kim, Dennis Moynihan, and Jenny Filippazzo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
We don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer for only love.